Hello again to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today we have an interesting conversation. Going Godward on Twitter reached out to me wanting to introduce me to her friend, Will Caverly. And Will has a very interesting background, very relevant to Doomer Optimism. And Will, you express that, you know, you had a lot of resonance with what we're doing at Doomer Optimism. Of course, GG, I'm going to refer to you as GG from here going forward. You know, we're in like group chats together and stuff, so we're familiar on the internet, but this is kind of our first time meeting face to face, so this is exciting. So maybe we can start, GG, if you want to kind of introduce yourself and then maybe set the context for the conversation, and then Will can introduce himself.
Sure. So I'm Going Godward on Twitter. I have a real name. It's not actually Going, but Go by Going Godward there. My background is social work. I moved into school-based therapy, but when I was doing social work, I was working for a federally funded preschool program and worked out of the library that Will was doing fundraising for, to do parent meetings and to do training sessions and things like that for parents. And so Will and I just having to share that space kind of became collaborative in what we were doing. And because we learned that we had, you know, similar interests, we'd read similar things. His background is very different than mine, but I think his mom is actually a social worker, maybe. I can't remember. Right. Yeah. So we shared a little bit of that and just kept in touch over time. And Will shared writings with me. He shared podcasts with me. I've learned a lot from Will personally. I just really respect him as a person and just professionally. So he wrote a book called The Fundraising Survival Guide that he passed along to me. I guess it was like a year ago or something.
Yeah.
And he also wrote a novel, Hear the Bee Sting. I know he's a beekeeper as well. Passed along those books. I've listened to Will's podcast. The Fundraising Survival Guide is excellent. But he has started a family since then. And he has been homesteading for many years. He's been a hippie. He's been a hippie. He's played the hippie role, I believe.
Yeah. Done that.
A little bit. But he just is moving toward that place of, I think, balance between, like, you know, self-sufficiency, sustainability, but also, like, there are modern technologies. There are things that we want to incorporate that are not bad. We don't want to reject everything. We want to incorporate what we can. He's written a couple of articles for Front Porch Republic. One where he kind of, I don't know if it's coining a term, but develops a term, anarcho-capitalism. That's a mouthful. Not anarcho-capitalism.
That already exists.
Pastoralism. Yeah. You'll have to edit that out, Jason. Say it wrong. Anarcho-pastoralism. And then another article where he kind of says, okay, you know, we're going to throw up our hands. We're going to incorporate some modern technology into our homesteading and not be completely organic. Is that the gist, Will?
That's it. What a great intro.
Okay. Anyway, y'all are going to love Will. He's definitely a fellow traveler with the Doomer Optimism group, and I'm just so excited to finally get him here.
Yeah, this is awesome. Thank you for having me. Of course, this is awesome. Very honored to be here. Love what you guys are doing. As GG said, 10 years a homesteader. I live in southeastern Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, in what often is called the exurbs. I can hear the shots from a rifle range not too far away. Over to my right is State Game Lands that goes out 8,000 acres or so. And behind me, past the American flag, are the peach trees, which has done really well this year. I've never had a peach harvest like this before. I mean, it's like I'm like that stock photo of the guy with the limes. I'm like carrying peaches just all the time. So suffice to say, I love being a homesteader. And yeah, just started a family. We have a 4-month-old, just going on 4 months, and a 2-year-old. So just recently, until the 1st of September, I was had two under two. Now it's one just above two, and the other one a tiny baby that doesn't sleep. So bear with me. I think I had 4 hours of sleep last night. We're working through it. Things we're working through. But in terms of what I've done, my wife and I ran a podcast that's sort of on hiatus right now. The original Transplants podcast that we podcasted for about 5 years talking through everything having to do with the homestead. That was beekeeping, chickens, this orchard behind me, everything having to do with permaculture and developing a food forest, which I would say at this point, 10 years in, it's starting to look like a food forest. You know, it only took 10 years and it's starting to get there. But we're harvesting quite a bit off of it. And in addition to that, I do writing. I've twitchy fingers. I can't stop. It's what I do. It's how I think through things. And as Gigi said, that's how I was thinking through my recent problem, which is whether to stay organic and to stay, I don't know, Amish style and just use hand tools. I decided against that because number one, there's several reasons, but number one is that I'm old, and number two is that I have small children. But you can find more on that article, and I'm sure we'll talk through all of that. But yeah, just happy to be here. Hopefully that lays a little bit out about what I'm about and gets us into it.
Yeah, great. And you're also in your email to me, you talked about a study you're doing, like an urban program or something. Do you want to?
Yeah, I'm actually in the middle. I have a book deal with Brookline Books, which is a small imprint that does Philadelphia history, and through Casemate Publishing is the big publisher on that. And what I'm doing is a history of a neighborhood in Southwest Philadelphia that was a victim, I guess you could say, of urban renewal. Urban renewal sounds nice, but mid 20th century, the federal government paid quite a bit of money to municipalities like the city of Philadelphia to bulldoze entire neighborhoods. And in Southwest Philly, I believe it was the largest by geographic area, not by population, but the largest by geographic area of urban renewal. And 8,000 people lost their homes, over 8,000 people. Somewhere between 8 and 10, honestly, they don't know. There's no records to pick that apart. My book tracks the resistance movement to that urban renewal project that started around the 50s and, you know, bled into the 60s, and also a simultaneous movement to save the John Hines National Wildlife Refuge, which is a great big swamp down there in Southwest Philly and into Delaware County, further to the west, which was a successful grassroots movement, I guess you could say. So what you've got are two parallel movements, one that failed, that was very much a working class group of people, and the other one that succeeded, and it was, let's just say, well moneyed and well connected. And it's been a fascinating journey. This is the first time in a very long time anybody's asked me any questions, because I've been asking lots of people lots of questions. And it's been a fun experience putting together a book about the 50s, because it's far enough back that the records are not easy to get. It's far enough back that many of the people are dead who were involved with it on the firsthand. But on the other hand, you find people who are in their 80s who are just flattered to be asked about it, right? Oh yeah, I used to live in this neighborhood. Oh yeah, I got moved. I sat on this deck right here, and talked with the gentleman whose family was moved three, four times as the urban renewal project chewed through this neighborhood, bulldozer, doing one house after another, and ended up returning to the neighborhood after many decades to be a community organizer there. So it's been a trip, but that book is tentatively called Silt and Cinder. And it's Eastwick, Tinicum, and the Remaking of Southwest Philadelphia.
Okay, great. Okay, so there's a lot of different directions we can go in here. Let's start very broad. Sometimes I know Ashley likes to compose podcasts this way, where she's like, "What's your kind of sense of doom? Where's the doomer? And then where's the optimism?" So like, what's your, you know, so you're talking about this urban renewal, quote unquote, urban renewal project. You're anarcho-pastoralist, you're a homesteader. That's in a kind of an eclectic mix of interests. How do these all fit into your kind of diagnosis about the trajectory of society, the kind of imminent, you know, the danger signs, and what you think, you know, like what are some better trajectories that you push for?
Yeah, great. I could definitely jump into that. In 2012 or so, I believe, was the Occupy Wall Street protests, and the you know nationwide. I got a chance to talk through email with David Graeber at the time, who became a major sort of figure in my intellectual development. And sadly, he passed away a couple years ago. My wife and I were involved with that. I mean, we were on the front lines of it. We didn't camp out in Dilworth Plaza, but we thought about it. Speaking of Mayor Dilworth, I have a lot of words for him now that I've done this research from the 1950s, and that plaza that was named after him was where the encampments took place. Specific, you know, a lot of words went around about what Occupy Wall Street stood for, what the point was, what are the demands. That was often the thing thrown about. For my wife and I, it was, we can't believe the government is going to send tons and tons of money to banks in order to bail out bad decisions. And we had a whole other list of grievances if you had asked us at the time. We protested in that, watched the encampments get bulldozed, and we were living in Delaware County, fairly close to where my book is about in Southwest Philly, Delaware County, and said, you know, we're not really keen on what's going on with cities and whether people are being heard, things like that. And we had taken up an interest in gardening as early as our first apartment, where we grew a little mint plant on a fire escape. Like, hey, this gardening thing is pretty cool. And it expanded, and now long story short, we moved out to the country with zero experience. I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in a suburban house. I had no idea how to operate a chainsaw. I think I might have worked one once. What I tell in the article, the anarcho-pastoralism article, which is called "There's No More Room," which was on Front Porch Republic, I talk about how the first thing somebody told me was, when you go out to the country, you need to buy a chainsaw, a generator, and a gun. That's what you need to live out here. And you know, we were both in higher ed. Both of us have had whole careers in higher education. And I was like, wait a second, wait, where do we move out to? So we had this very romantic vision of what it's supposed to look like when you escape the urban and move out to the rural. And so that's been part of our journey. But in terms of where our my doomer sense of things came from, was a lot of it's informed by medieval to late medieval sociologist from North Africa called Ibn Khaldun, who I studied in my graduate degree. Ibn Khaldun is a cyclical history fan. He wrote an entire cyclical history of North Africa, and his belief was that societies crumble without social cohesion, and he called it asabia. I won't get into the Arabic background of the term, but this idea of social cohesion being a currency, I guess you could call it, that rises and falls with certain societies. He was looking at North Africa, and at the time the Arabs had invaded and displaced Europeans from Spain. You might have heard that there was Arabic influences in southern Spain. The Arabs had left the Middle East during the rise of Muhammad and all the events there, made their way to North Africa. The indigenous North Africans overthrew the Arabs, and it was his belief that that was because they had a purer sense of social cohesion. They were religious zealots. They meshed with each other. They had an absolute sense of what was right and wrong. And he believed, Ibn Khaldun believed, that societies that become urbanized start to lose their social cohesion and become decadent and decaying. And so here I am. I'm reading this in graduate school. I'm piecing these things together, and I'm watching from an urban place. My wife and I were very much in I took the trolley to work every day. You know, we were in an urban space. I'm watching what I think is looks a lot like decay, and where that overthrow comes from is a mystery to me. I still don't know. But if we are on a path of less social cohesion, which I do, I really need to. Do I really need to? I know your audience, right? Your audience is like, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about here, right? There's a distinct lack of agreed upon narrative in the United States. There's a distinct lack of respect for other opinions, things like this. We could hash these things out all day, but to me, that's sort of been proven. That we're on some kind of downward trajectory. Most people, you look at the polling, people agree generally that things are not right in the state of Denmark. So we are, it was my opinion, yeah, that we may be looking at a decaying society, and that sort of the foundational ideas of the revolution. This idea of free speech, privacy, are things that are going out the window. Things like the Snowden leaks showed that there's essentially a totalitarian state spying on every single move that people make. That's quite a bit of power. So it was like, let's bug out. Can we really trust urban infrastructure anymore? Is this where we want to live? And that's how we ended up out here. That's essentially where my doomer side comes from. Is I feel like we may be the better. How do I phrase this? The best times may be over for the American experiment. That's where I'm sort of coming in on this. What it gets replaced with, I'm not sure. Do people get sick of elections and just elect a military junta, and that's what we deal with, and we sort of argue over who gets to lead a military junta? Do we continue with a democratic state or a republic that the elections are, you're electing who you're electing, and you know, everybody's sort of holding their nose about it and nobody's particularly happy? Do we continue electing people who are in their 80s? You know, I'm watching multiple people from both parties staring into cameras, not knowing what to do. There's some very disturbing things. So that's where the doomer side comes in. That said, and maybe this is the next part of your question, is about where the optimism comes from. That said, when we moved out here, we're on the edge of, we're in the exurbs. So everything's that an urban center like Philadelphia, which has the best academic medical centers in the world, some of them, it has all the resources you could want. It has the higher education institutions that make me money. They're still accessible to me. So in that sense, I'm tapping still into the system while also growing a lot of peaches.
Nice.
So that's sort of where the beginning and end of where I think I would say my doomer side is.
Okay. GG, do you have any questions or?
Oh,
you're muted.
The story of you're muted. No, I don't have any. I know Will's story. I kind of know his progression here. You know, I think I've talked with other people. You mentioned your doomer side started when you were living in an urban setting. And you were saying that in an urban setting, people tend to lose social cohesion. Yes, that's what you said.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because, you know, in an urban setting, you're living much closer together. You would think that would create more social cohesion, but I've worked in urban settings and in rural settings, and the rural communities are much more close-knit, much more supportive of one another. And just, you know, how would you explain that? What would you say about that? Why that happens?
Yeah, as for why, I mean, there's been experiments done where you overpopulate mice in a you know, very small setting, all kinds of weird things happen. They start doing the social dynamics change for mice. So we can only, you know, speculate what it does for humans. This is the most urbanized period in human history. This is a giant experiment. Nobody's ever done this before. So what it looks like now, and then maybe what it looks like 50 years from now, when you have a megalopolis, let's say, that stretches from Boston all the way down to, I don't know, Roanoke, right? Like, or even further, like it's just expanding. The suburbs are marching my way. Out here, even I'm seeing housing developments go up 20 minutes from me in a big way. It's coming, and it's getting stronger in that sense. So where that comes from, I have no idea, but I will tell you that, and it may be a function of renting versus owning, but when we moved out here, the first thing that happened was everybody on our street came and introduced themselves within the first week. Whereas I had neighbors that lived next to me for years that I didn't know their names. I didn't know much about them. We didn't even nod at each other when we left the house. You know, there was even a gentleman I had taken an African lit course with. He was my professor who lived down the street from me, and I didn't know it for 2 years. Like, that's, you know, and I'm talking eight houses down from me. I just had no idea he was there. Definitely different. And I don't know. part of I think something I speculate in the There's No Room essay is that the space, the distance apart from each other engenders a little bit of, I don't know, neighborly good behavior. But I also think having a common enemy is a big deal for creating a community. And that common enemy, when you're in a rural space, is nature. There many rural spaces are rural spaces because they're marginal lands that is not great for building on. You live up in the mountains, there are no giant housing developments up in the mountains without a lot of factors being involved in it. And in my case, living out here, there's been enough desirable land that's been eaten up by development that we'll see what happens out here. But it kind of stinks when the weather gets bad out here, and having that kind of common enemy among among your neighbors is great. And so one of the examples I've thrown around a lot is that the school bus used to turn around in my driveway down here, and one day it turned around and it got stuck on a snowbank, and me and the neighbors pitched in. I mean, the one woman was in high heels. This is one of the moms of the kids. This was long before I had my kids. And me and the lady in the high heels used shovels to dig the school bus out of the snowbank. And so I got to say I saved the school bus full of children before work. But that kind of that common enemy is and I keep using the word enemy, and probably there's somebody at their computers typing, "How dare you call it the enemy? How dare you call the Earth Mother the enemy?" But there is a sense of animosity and even hate towards nature that it's going to crop up, and you'd have to be inhuman not to sometimes just be annoyed and at what happens. And my favorite, and the example we always tell around here, and we told to our daughter or toddler, is we saved a family of mice from the house early on here. First year we were here, saved a little family of mice, moved their little nest outside. Like they had been living in some chair or something, moving outside. And then my wife was planting seedlings, had tomato seedlings for the season coming up, and a mouse came back into the house, and I eventually found the hole and ate all of her tomato seedlings, like right off. And it was like, I think there's something else going on here. I could be the hippie about this, but it does harden you in a sense, and it creates a common sense of like a little bit of an us versus them, which I think actually helps with that social cohesion. And actually, if you go back to Khaldun, Khaldun saw a rural invasion. In his case, it was nomads from the Sahara. So there's a lot of people who had been tempered by the Saharan desert who were tough as nails. All they ate was camel meat. All they drank was camel milk, right? That was their diet, and they were some tough bastards. And they came screaming out of the desert and overthrew the Arab empire at the time. And he also studied another movement that came out of the mountains and did the same thing. Once the desert folk got urbanized, got corrupt, got decadent, and he tracked how a couple hundred years later they were overthrown by a group with more social cohesion. So is it that ruralism tempers you, makes you tougher? It might be part of it. Does it give you a common adversary sometimes? Yeah, I definitely think so.
I was thinking too, and this is just a thought that popped into my head. In rural settings, you have room to spread out. You have your territory. I mean, you have a little bit of space. And I think sometimes I know what I've experienced being in an urban setting, working there, is everybody's kind of fighting for their territory. They're fighting for their space. And I think that makes everybody kind of ramp up. They kind of get antsy when their space is kind of being invaded. And you just don't have that as much in a rural setting because you do have the space to kind of spread out. I don't know. That's just something I just thought of because I know working in the urban setting, people are always fighting over their territories.
Huh.
Yeah.
The way you framed like the common enemy of nature is interesting. Like the way it's similar to what I would the way I would frame it, in that in a rural area, like so I live in an unincorporated area. We don't have many of the services that an urban urban resident would have, and there's more of like you have to take care of each other, and that could be like take care of them from nature, but also take care of them with nature, right? Sharing your produce, and there seems to be more of like, there has to be more interdependence because there's less technological infrastructure to serve your needs. Whereas in an urban setting, because you have so much, you know, of your needs met, and with that, so you have more kind of safety, but then with that, you probably have less freedom. There's less perennial tension there, right? You know, you start getting kind of just different kind of cultural trajectories. And then, of course, there's historical, tense relationships between the urban and the rural, right? The urban settings need to bring in resources, often, you know, from rural areas, oftentimes, you know, through processes that, you know, either, you know, take over land or require some kind of commodity production, you know, and entering into the market economy that rural residents, you know, perhaps they were more kind of, as a community, self-sufficient, all of a sudden need to enter the market economy to serve these commodity markets. And or they, you know, they just get their land taken from them, you know, either by outright force or through, you know, through some kind of, you know, debts, you know, debt relationships or whatever it happens to be. And so there's this kind of, you know, dependency of urban areas on rural areas. But now we're also seeing that, you know, a lot of people are leaving rural areas. Rural areas are getting hollowed out, going to urban settings. I mean, I was just talking to a local guy, and he was talking about how his nephew was going to sell off their piece of land that they had in the family for hundreds of years after his, you know, after their grandmother died, and, you know, moved to probably a more urban center to go find jobs. And so we're kind of seeing this hollowing out of rural areas into the urban, but then the urban areas, you know, by your account, are becoming more dysfunctional. And so it's an interesting dynamic where it's still drawing people in, even though it's not really serving human needs. Any thoughts on that?
I dig it. Yeah, I dig it. Yeah, it seems to me that, yeah, when you're surviving in an urban setting, this synthesizes, I think, kind of what you're both talking about. Getting what you need is a matter of politics and capital. And that is 100% of what you can get is you're either getting it through the water authority, right? You're arguing with the water authority about, or checking their levels to make sure they haven't, you know, put lead into the pipe, you know, put lead pipes down, things like that, and arguing with politicians over, you know, remediating things like that. Or it's a matter of whether they opened a supermarket in your neighborhood or decided your neighborhood was too high risk to open a supermarket, which when I did a little bit of social work and I touched social work for a year and a half and decided, checked out, GG, I checked out myself, you're at the whim of whatever the corporation is deciding to do at the time and their risk analysis. One of the things that worries me, and going back on the doomer train, man, look at me. I thought I was going to come on this optimist, you know, an optimist. On the doomer train, what I worry about is the United States is sort of heading in a European direction where you've got like a calcified social structure and land ownership. You live in Europe, you have much, much less of a chance to buy land because the land has been bought, sold, traded, carved up, set in place for thousands of years, maybe in some cases. We're headed in that direction very quickly where you already have folks operating in the hinterland. I know Bill Gates is buying up a ton of farmland himself, and that there are foreign investors doing the same thing. What I worry about is, yeah, we are running out of room in the sense that moneyed interests can pick up that land and basically turn the society into a renter society. And maybe that's the progression of every new landmass. I don't know. Definitely, if you lived in the area I studied in the 20th century, this area in Southwest Philadelphia, it was a rural kind of neighborhood where people kept bees. People kept actually, I didn't have any evidence of bees. I had evidence, plenty of evidence of chickens, horses. One family moved homes from home to home on a horse-drawn wagon. This was in the 1950s in Southwest Philadelphia. You're still have people keeping horses. They leveled that in order to create modern developments. And I think I've heard that the United States population is going to level out to a certain extent, but it still seems that that carving up of spaces is happening. And all the farms you're talking about is where, the only reason that the farm over my shoulder is not going to do that is it was put into a land trust, and it will remain a farm as long as they enforce that statute and that contract. But that was the advantage of moving out to where we are, is that there was a couple land trusts operating, and you guys are familiar with, probably your listeners and watchers are familiar with land trust systems, but essentially creating covenants where a farm can remain a farm or a forested area can remain a forested area. Quite nice if you end up right next to one of those. But I was talking with part of my story in this book is about one of the major land trusts in the greater Philadelphia area, and them evolving out of that grassroots movement to save this marsh. They've turned into the big land trust around here. But I was talking to the director, and he said it's brutal right now, right? The real estate prices have gone so high so fast that you're priced out if you want to try to pay for development rights on a piece of land. So that's a little scary too. That means a lot of land is going to get turned into turned over by Pulte, Toll Brothers. And I'm really starting to sound like a Greenpeace person. And I don't know if this is one of those inevitable things, like I said, when you look over a long timeline and you look at the history of any land mass, whether this is just the progression that humans take. And the United States just happens to be the latest, one of the last areas that had been subject to, I guess, capital and private property and those ideas.
Where does the in your kind of, sense of progression of history and United States, and your sense of doom, where does kind of our biophysical situation figure in? Like, what do you think about our agricultural system, how it relates to urbanization, the sustainability of our agricultural system, or other biodiversity loss, water tables going down, et cetera. It seems to me that if all else being equal, if there was infinite supply of of healthy environments, that this would be the natural progression it would go, and it wouldn't look very good. But then we have this other, in my view, this other crisis, this biophysical crisis, looking at climate, looking at biodiversity, looking at pollution of waterways and chemical loads in our bodies and in the environment, et cetera. It seems like it's running into a wall, and unfortunately it's also the foundation of our life support systems, and so our life support systems are running into a wall, but it's also potentially undermining this trajectory of like increasing capitalization, increasing centralization of corporate power, et cetera. They seem to be kind of in some sense kind of at odds with each other. But maybe not. What do you think about that?
I have a lot of complicated feelings on environmental policy, land use, and ultimately climate change and things, those related issues. I spend a lot of time in the woods out here. I'm a bow hunter. It's something I picked up some years ago, and I absolutely love going after deer. That said, like the carrying capacity of deer on the landscape is all messed up. What we call nature, which is big giant white tail bucks running around that I put on my wall or whatever, this is not at all what it looked like, 600, 700 years ago. There's more deer than ever, and it's causing all kinds of strange havoc on the landscape, and that's partially us carving our way into the Penn's Woods here in Pennsylvania. But it strikes me that we have like the best of times, worst of times at the moment. We have some very clean air and clean water compared to what I've read about. One of the cases in the 40s in Pennsylvania was a factory town out near Pittsburgh where they had you folks got the smog, right? Did you get the smog down where you were, Jason?
From the Canadian,
From the Canadian wildfires.
we did,
Yeah, and I mean,
it wasn't
as
that
I'm
bad. Oh, it was definitely there. No, it's there.
Okay. See, we had it pretty bad, and as I understand it, it was a certain weather pattern happened to push all the smoke down from the stratosphere. Well, there was a town out in Pittsburgh where that happened, except there was industrial pollution. It pushed it down. I believe 50 people died in a day or some horrible disaster. It was awful. I have the citation in my book if anybody's interested of that disaster. But it was the industrial pollution back in the day was horrific, and we just do not have that. I've had a chance to talk with the folks who run the Superfund site down in Southwest Philly. That's part of this book, because of course this neighborhood, after they kicked 8,000 people out, they then the dumps there were later defined as a Superfund site because of the horrific pollution down there. And those folks are doing amazing work. Those guys from the EPA down there are working as hard as they can to entomb forever chemicals, PFAS, all that nasty stuff that's down there. So we've got these really nasty environmental problems, but I don't think we've ever thrown, I mean, as a nation, we've never thrown the type of resources we throw out as we do now. So even if, and one of the things I struggle with climate change is the idea of abstaining from carbon consumption. Seems to me to be a failing strategy. And I think ultimately we're going to end up in a geoengineering solution, which is I'm not a huge fan of by any means. But I just think it's kind of inevitable at this point that if the warming climate is as much of a problem as predictions say it is, we're going to end up in this geoengineering solution that I don't think anybody wants, but seems inevitable to me. It's going to affect the way humans move across this landscape. It's ultimately, as we learn more about what pollution we've done in the past, it's going to change where people live. And I'm afraid every day. I've got a nuclear power plant like 20 miles to the east, which is good for wind. It's not going to blow fallout my way, but these things scare me. There is definitely a precarious situation, and all it takes is something like the internet shutting down for a day. I actually went to a doctor's office recently. I was like, what would you do if the internet, I shouldn't ask people this kind of stuff because they're going to flag me and they're going to kick me out. But what would you do if the internet went down for a day in the health system? She was like, oh yeah, well, that happened at a hospital recently. They just had to move everybody to the other hospital. I was like, yeah, but what if the internet went down for a day? What would you do? And it was like the little buffering sign was in this person's head. God bless her. Like she was doing the best she could with somebody who's clearly an insane person asking her stupid questions. But those are the types of things that worry me. We have a lot of precarious situations that rely on very complex infrastructure. And so there's my doomer take on it. We're doing the best we've ever done, and at the same time, the stakes seem very high.
Yeah. Well,
I'm
maybe
sorry,
this will
Jason.
lead into the conversation about your kind of homesteading experiments. Because I want to dig a little bit more into kind of the agricultural side of this equation. So my kind of major interest and focus is on food systems, and I don't see the industrial food system as sustainable. I'm not sure that even if we wanted to keep burning fossil fuels, that we would have the same abundance that we've had, in the next few decades. And that would, have, huge implications for the food system, right? The diesel that we have to use for the tractors, all the transport networks, the fertilizers, all of these things, not to mention topsoil loss, and pollution of the waterways and various other things. And you and your homesteading, you started off organic, so presumably you had some ideals about these issues and kind of where agriculture should move towards, at least on a small scale. And you found, in many ways that certain things weren't pragmatic. And do you want to talk about kind of your initial thinking about that and how it's evolved, and where is kind of this balance?
Yeah, Gigi, you were going to say something. Did you have something?
I'll hold out because it's a little bit of a, I think, a good ending question. So
All
we'll keep
right.
going with this.
I like it. All right. I mean, one of the reasons we moved out here was become food self-sufficient. And suffice to say, like I said, food forest is growing out here. But if we had to survive off of what I could get on this homestead, we would die. And there's just no way I can edge around that. We don't have the amino acids produced here. We don't have the carbohydrates we need to feed a family of four, right? It just would not happen. That said, we could spend a lot of time processing food and do a pretty good job. It was one of the reasons we came out here was we had some nerves about the food supply. We get Lancaster Farming, which is a great newspaper for Pennsylvanians that seems like everybody out here gets it. And they cover a lot of these issues. I'm with you on definitely fear about the food supply. When you look at how many, I don't know, plastics are used in the course of there's a corn, you know, alternating corn soy field down there. The plastics, the Roundup, the things used in order to do to just get that bushel of corn off the field, it's pretty staggering, what's needed. At the same time, I heard, I think it was Steve Rinella who does the Meat Eater podcast, which is a hunting podcast I listen to, and he pointed out that this food system was created by people who were children of the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, things like that. These were people who were fundamentally scarred by food insecurity. And his point was, and I don't know what citations he had to back this up, but it made sense to me. His point was, these people said, nobody will be hungry ever again. We're going to make sure nobody's hungry ever again. And if that means putting a million chickens in a disgusting chicken house with giant fans to keep them from overheating and dying, and then killing them all with foam when they get the bird flu, you know, this is what we're going to do in order to make sure nobody's hungry. So it seems to me to be an overcorrection. And I'm actually optimistic that it can move in the right direction. I have already seen them go to no-till next door at this cornfield, which is, it's nice to see. That said, they still drop Roundup all over it because you're not tilling it, but you let the weeds grow up, you know, you let alfalfa grow up, you harvest that, and then you blast it again. I was like, wait, I thought no-till was like some organic woo-woo stuff that, you know, it's all good, man. We're gonna be very green. I'm like, wait, oh, okay, they're dumping Roundup on it anyway. It definitely, it scares me. I mean, there's it's quite, it seems precarious sometimes. I remember seeing something about the cattle being taken into slaughter in Texas, and you just had they had a drought, and could not feed the cattle, and it's just they all went to slaughter, and then you're regrowing herds from there. It's a little frightening. So I probably am not the right person to ask about anything detailed on ag. I've read Lancaster Farming for years, but not as closely as I should. When my wife and I were still doing the original transplants podcast, we talked about it every episode. We had some ag news. I am optimistic. There's definitely way more awareness, again, just sort of on the environmental side, way more awareness than there used to be. Before it was the miracles of the chemical industry. It was DDT, all kinds of great stuff coming out of the chemical industry. You can just dump. Good. We're good to go. We're good to go for another season. That's not really acceptable anymore. And there's a lot of legislative action. I guess one of the things I struggle with is, yeah, we can have legislative action. We can have the EPA involved in these things, but ultimately it probably takes a change in ethics on the personal level. And I don't know how you change the ethics of that many people all at the same time, or if you should be forcing it down people's throats, or if they should really come around to it themselves. Unfortunately, it probably will take the worst to change the attitudes on it, like finding out that, I don't know, finding out that, you know, one of these chemicals is causing widespread cancer across the country or something would be the thing that galvanizes. It's probably just going to be something terrible. Isn't it always something terrible that galvanizes the action, right? So yeah, I'm worried about it. I'm worried about it, man. But I try not to be because I'm eating some of it. and I can't make everything myself.
Gigi, you want to jump in?
Well, I don't really have much to add to the agriculture conversation because I can't even grow a tomato plant. So I'm like pre-homesteading. I'm still on that. I'm going to learn everything I can before I ever embark on something. But I don't know if it's time for this question or not, but I wanted to ask, you were talking about human need, and meeting human need. And I guess this is maybe a little too philosophical for a doomer optimism. Hopefully not. But you have a philosophy background, don't you, Will?
I do, yeah.
So I guess just in addressing all these things, what would you say is the greatest human need, and what is the best way to meet that need? And does it play into any of this that we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, Maslow did it, right? And maybe if we go back to the Khaldun discussion, the North African scholar who identified, decadence, it may be that when urbanization takes care of all your needs, you get into the chattering classes problem where you become Marx called it petite bourgeoisie, right? You get into this issue of you have nothing else left to do, and so you just start acting, in the decadent way that eventually could lead to your own downfall. At least according to Khaldun. I'm not saying it's eventuality, but humans need work. I mean, we need something to do that's meaningful, and for a lot of people, that's, and myself included, that's raising food. I could go get peaches from the Amish down the road, and they might be better. They might be better than mine. They certainly grow better watermelons than I do. Our watermelons just never seem to grow the way theirs do. But I have, great satisfaction in harvesting it. But not everybody is. Sorry, not everybody's good at making food. Sorry, not everybody's good at making food. No, I'm just kidding. And not everybody finds satisfaction in it. And when you're trying to get to the top of Maslow's hierarchy and you're getting into self-actualization, not everybody's finding self-actualization in creating food or having anything to do with food other than having somebody serve it to you. But there is something. I've had this article idea knocking around in my head lately of things you remember that you never experienced yourself. This is woo-woo. We're getting woo-woo here for a minute, but when you're harvesting and you get into that worry about the season, I wonder if it's going to rain this season, or you're looking out the window, you're like, it hasn't rained in 2 weeks. Like my squash plants are, I'm not going to use that expletive. They're right, my squash are done for. My tomatoes are getting blossom end rot, and they're a mess because it's rained too much. That worry that you get starts to put you into, I think, sort of like an ancestral recollection, right? Where you're getting that kind of a deep satisfaction out of working in the land, but part of that is the worry and the anticipation of making sure that the harvest comes in, or finding a bunch of berries in the woods. Those types of things are, I think, are limitless. I think they're incredible experiences, but it's very ephemeral. It's really hard to nail down, and I think it's a human need to engage in that kind of work. But how you can scale that and make that work there. Somebody just sent me an article from Harper's where it was sort of a thought experiment, science fiction story. And I'll send you the article if you want to put in the show notes or whatever. Where everybody gets a letter in the mail and it says, you're now working on salamander extinction prevention and things like that. Everybody gets a letter in the mail, and it was a great article that and little story that showed what it would take for humans to really put their hands to soil and stop using all the things that Josh just talked about, right? Fossil fuels, things like that. This soybean field behind me this year, what would it take for everybody to be out there harvesting it? And would they really find the satisfaction of work, or would they just be like, get me out of the sun, this is horrible. Why don't we have a tractor doing this? Why aren't we burning a bunch of fossil fuels in order to make this happen? I don't have a way to square all of that. And if it is an ethic, like a land ethic, like Aldo Leopold talks about in Sand County Almanac, if there is a land ethic that needs to be taught and reinforced and brought to the fore, I still have not figured out how that's taught. At the moment, it's enforced by the federal government and state governments and things like that. And you have private organizations that are helping with that. But for the most part, it's an enforcement mechanism of environmental protection. And can you get it to work in the opposite direction of it being a proactive thing? Like, to use the American example, would people enslave people now if slavery was not illegal? I don't know. Have we gotten past that part? Right? Or are we, if slavery all of a sudden was just, we said, okay, we're just to ignore that law. It's just no longer part of, the prohibition on slavery is no longer there. Would people immediately start getting back into it, like a bad coat you put on? I don't know. What can we do in order to create more environmental awareness, and save that food system before it's too late? I just don't know. I'm at a loss, and I don't think it'll probably be solved in my lifetime, is my guess. The For one, human population is going to rise, and I think it's going to top out in like 2100, something like that. Is the current projection that the African continent is growing very quickly. I think Nigeria is supposed to be the biggest country in the world by the end of the century, on their current growth path, taking out India. That's a, fundamentally many, 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 many more people. So we still have a lot of people to feed, and hopefully global population growth can be balanced a little bit and it self-corrects. Because I don't like legislation having to do with correcting the population issue, which is the incipient issue when it comes to the food system. So that's my huge equivocating answer to that. I don't know. And where humans find satisfaction in that and their needs are met, I have not been able to square that circle.
Well, what I've heard you say is that human need, the human need for self-actualization, that is the greatest need, and that is achieved through work, whatever work you find satisfying.
Self-actualization, though, is about the hardest thing you can actually get to, but in a an advanced society like ours, is more attainable, or at least there's more striving towards it, because so many of the other layers are handled, right? Food is not an issue, water is not an
All those
issue,
needs are met, right?
all it's met. So yeah, can you turn people's work into something that's satisfying at the same time? Beats me. I don't I'm not the person to do it, because what I did was ran off to the country. So I'm not the one who's going to come up with a great solution, except maybe to share things on podcasts like this, talk with you guys.
Well, let's dig into that a bit more. You framed it as kind of an escape from the city and kind of a self-protective measure. And there's a lot of people who are doing it now. I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers historically, but it seems just anecdotally that a lot of people are doing it or interested. A lot of people can't afford the land. That's a whole other set of topics, right? Land access for people who want to do it. But do you see it purely in terms of kind of escape, kind of a crumbling society, or do you see it in your more hopeful days as some kind of prefiguration of, of a different society, right? Like that, that can kind of lead a transition towards maybe, for example, smaller scale farms that have more human management, maybe not as energy intense, maybe not completely cutting out diesel fuel or whatever, but some kind of balance there. And then I want to bring in this term that you identify as the anarcho-pastoralist. And you mentioned David Graeber, and David Graeber was, I guess I would describe him as a social anarchist. So he's big on kind of decentralized human living systems, kind of autonomous communities, etc. Do you see this in terms of at all in terms of prefiguration potentially of something like that, or you think that's too idealistic?
That's probably too, maybe I might have believed that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even. But at this point, I think there may be a segment of the population like myself that likes to chase the edge, and that there will always be an edge. And it's actually something I discuss a little bit in this book I'm writing, where when I started looking at urban renewal policy, a lot of federal government policy in the early 20th century, including the Great Depression, had to do with rural, like keeping rural areas economically solvent. And that was a lot of FDR's work was on that. As the 20th century went on, the frontiers, what they called the frontiers and things like that, were seen as cities, and it started to close in on itself. And that's when this urban policy, Robert Moses was in New York clearing slums. And then in this case, Philadelphia had Ed Bacon and William Rafsky, Ed Bacon being Kevin Bacon's dad. So that was funny to watch. But you had a change in attitude where the frontiers became very much urban. I think with work from home and things like that has changed the game quite a bit on people getting out of urban areas and moving out here. I certainly have seen it. I've seen a lot of work from home transplants end up out here. I ended up working from home by choice, and that really was amazing. That's exactly what I've always wanted. And I remember talking to my late grandfather, and I told him, "Well, maybe I can, as I take the train in, I can work while I'm commuting." And he said, "That's not a real job," which was, and he was a Greatest Generation. It's like, that's not a job. What are you talking about? You can't just work on the train or work from your house. That's not real. Sorry, Grandpa. But that's my long rambling way of saying there, it may be that cynically I'm part of the population that always is going to need to stay on that outside edge. And where that outside edge lands depends on your historical circumstances. And that there may be a certain segment of the population like myself that's just like, I'm not playing this part of the game. Like, get me out and move me out here. That said, I lived in urban areas for a while, commuted through the city, everything, and was having a great time as well. So maybe that's too cynical, and maybe I'm being a little bit self-effacing that way. But whether there's a movement towards this and whether it has any traction, I think it does. There's a great book called Rural Radicals. Again, this is another one I'm going to need to find for you that I have on my shelf. And a lot of the book ended up fo focusing on the Grange, which was is still around, but sort of a farmer organizing group that ended up on doing some fairly radical activities having to do with like land sharing and things like that. I think you could potentially see things like that popping up in the next few decades, where it's a little bit more beyond, like, God bless him. I love Joel Salatin, but like he's not doing a call to arms. He's not doing a like here's how we're going to organize radically to create something new. He's doing all the right things, doing great work. But that Grange organization, from what I understand, it's been a while since I read this book, and I'm dredging up memories here. There were some very, very interesting rural radicalism movements that could lead to something like this. And it could be an environmental ra radicalism in the sense of, like, we can create a patchwork of farms that do what they need to do in order to be a model for elsewhere. I could see that happening. That's what we tried to do. We were running workshops on the homestead, and what we actually found out was we eventually hit capacity for folks who wanted to hear what we had to say about permaculture and the food forest and things like that, which was great. And we know that we changed people's lives and how they interact with their food, which was awesome. Like, I had for years people calling me being like, "Hey, I'm trying out this with rain barrels this week. I could use some advice," or "Hey, I want to catch bees. Like, how do I catch bees on my property?" Things like that. That was just, I mean, that's the greatest. But we hit a capacity of a certain group of people were receptive to that message. And then our classes started to fall in attendance. And so we went whole hog on the podcast, agriculture joke, whole hog. We went whole hog on the podcast. And then, of course, once the kids showed up, very difficult to do podcasts with screaming babies. I put my daughter to bed right before right before we went live. So we will pick that up because the homesteading goes on here. So yeah, it's I as you can see, I have a lot of different thoughts on it that range from fairly cynical of like we're running away, you know, folks like me or myself are running away from the problems at the center of society to yeah, this could be something cool that develops. And one of the neat things about the social movements like this is I don't think they're predictable. I think often they pop up in the strangest places. And that was certainly the case. It seemed like with Occupy Wall Street, that seemed to come out of nowhere. I won't even get started on like the surveillance state and the intelligence agencies because I don't want to go down the rabbit hole right now. We can skip that part. But what is it, you know, what is an organic or an organic movement and everything? But I think we could see some cool stuff because at some point it's necessary. But it might take an emergency to make it necessary, unfortunately.
Do you have any questions?
Any questions? I just wanted to make sure that we highlight what Will has produced in terms of articles and books. And is there any podcast that people can subscribe to at this point? Or are you kind of everything's on hiatus right now?
It's on hiatus. They're all still out there. So the original
Okay.
Transplants podcast is out there, 60 something episodes. The Tinderbox podcast, I believe, is still out there. I had a problem with hosting it, but in that one, I examine a couple different things. I examine labor movements. It's a history podcast. Gigi, I know you listen to
The
the
riots,
battle,
LA riots.
well, the LA riots and the Battle of Athens, Tennessee,
Yes,
where a bunch of World War II veterans came home and overthrew their local government. In the What's been pointed out to me now is the only successful rebellion since the American Revolution in the United States happened in rural Eastern Tennessee. So I did a podcast on that, and those are more like audiobooks, I guess, than podcasts, kind of broken up into a couple parts. Got my books, willcaverly.com, Caverly, and that's where you can find my stuff.
Well, and I just want to plug Will's book. I'm sure a lot of people in the doomer optimism audience has at least bumped up against an NGO at some point. And Will wrote a book that I think is the most hilarious book ever. And if you've lived in the NGO world, if you've done any sort of fundraising, if you've done any grant writing whatsoever, if you've accessed any of those areas, the fundraising survival guide is hysterical. My favorite part is when you say, if you want to get money, the best way to do that is to give an estimate as close to zero as possible. And then that would, and it was like the introduction, like just keep it short, like don't tell too much personal information. But I just highly recommend that book if you live in that world and it's very frustrating to you, getting volunteers, that kind of thing. It's just this little book and it's hilarious, and I just want everybody to read it if they've lived in that world.
And going back to our earlier question, and I don't want to drag this out, if you guys are ready to head out, but one of the main points of the book is I don't think meaningful change, and I say it and I try to say it in the funniest way possible, but I don't think there's a ton of meaningful change that comes from the nonprofit sphere at this point. I think it's become something other than what it was intended to be, and it's a relatively new industry in the sense of being an industry. So I would like to see something else come of it, some other type of organization, instead of the countless nonprofits who are spinning wheels constantly. So yeah, if you've had the misfortune of trying to fundraise for one of these organizations, that's fun. It might resonate with
Well,
Think if enough people read that, they would get out of the NGO business. Yeah, it's a good little book. Just go pick it up, and I just want to make sure that
don't
that gets
quit.
plugged.
Be careful quitting your job though. Just yeah, have another job lined up, please. Don't make me
Get something back.
impoverished
Yeah,
here.
back
Yeah.
up.
We'll include all of these links in the show notes, but we have a little bit of time left. I want to get into a little bit more. I did read your latest article in Front Porch Republic about your switch towards less organic methods. Give us some of the nitty-gritty of kind of the trade-offs you had to make there in your thinking process. Like what, you know, in terms of just, yeah, what trade-offs are you making, are you finding acceptable, and why are you making that shift?
Well, I wrote the article because I don't really find any of them acceptable, and I'm kind of upset at myself for undertaking them. But at the same time, it's even a little homestead like ours, 2.5 acres on the edge of giant woodlots, it has seemed impossible. And so I go through a couple of them. I'll highlight three. The first one is the invasive species. If any area of land in at least my part of the world, it might be different in higher latitudes. But down here in southeastern Pennsylvania, if you let a piece of land go, it does not become natural. It becomes choked with the most noxious invasive species you've ever seen in your life. Multiflora rose is my least favorite, but I have to respect this plant. It's a rose plant, and it will attack you back. And for years, I have hand cleared it. I have not used any chemicals whatsoever, and it's no longer working because these things send down taproots. I had a landscaper friend tell me the taproot 10 feet, right? It's sending these noxious roots down into the various parts of your yard, and it's almost impossible to eradicate. So I bought a weed whacker, and I was kind of angry at myself because I've been using a scythe for 10 years. But number one, shoulders aren't what they used to be. Number two, the amount of time it would take me to get some of these invasives knocked back and no longer having a foothold on my property so I can put in natives to replace them is it's an astronomical amount of time. And they just keep coming. The Game Commission does the best they can on this state game lands behind my house, but you go back there and it's choked with invasives. And so I just was struggling on what to do. So I bought this giant steel weed whacker, and it's called a brush cutter. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's an amazing piece of machinery. I love it. I mean, I have a smile on my face whenever I use it.
Sir, I have a scythe and I have a weed whacker, and so you
What are you
know
gonna do? Yeah.
we do. Yeah,
You, I mean,
weed
you try to
whacker
use
for
this stuff.
reasons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also have a mower now. I didn't used to have a mower, and I try
Yep.
and do a little bit of each depending on, but
I
yeah,
used real mowers, like the
I have
old.
a little electric mower. It's probably not suitable to the task,
Yeah.
but I haven't I haven't decided to scale that up yet.
It's one of those things where I got to a point where I couldn't keep up with it. Another one that disturbs me was we have tons of ticks out here. I've had Lyme disease once. It's not fun. And so I've started using permethrin spray on my clothing, which kills the ticks on contact. Unfortunately, kills everything else too. And we love our pollinators out here, but if I'm working for hours out in the yard, I can't afford to have like a month being out of commission where it's like being sick for a week, then 3 weeks of antibiotics where you're not allowed to be out in the sun, which is doxycycline. I don't have time for that. So I have started using permethrin on my clothes and haven't seen, have not had any tick bites. And I spend a lot of time keeping this place running. So that was another one. And the last one was beekeeping. I've kept bees for 7 years and I've lost a lot of bees. And there's an invasive mite species, the Varroa mite, that is probably single-handedly responsible for more bee deaths than anything. Folks talk about colony collapse disorder, but Varroa are the devil. In fact, that's what my book Here the Bees Sting is about, which is a fiction book actually. Involves a lot about Varroa mites. But I started using ametras, which is an acaricide, a kills arachnids, and it's I have used every organic method under the sun trying to treat these bees, and the Varroa are getting more and more noxious. And there are people trying to breed better bees to fight these Varroa mites, and I wish them all the best. I know Purdue has a great program trying to breed better bees, but I'm not smart enough to do that. I've tried to breed bees. It is very, very difficult. And I failed for 2 seasons and sort of said, I think I'm done with this because it's not working out and I'm spending a lot of time banging my head against the wall. And those were like three, two chemical interventions and one, I guess, physical intervention. I haven't really resorted to Roundup or whatever on some of these noxious invasives, but in the future I might have to if I want to if I want to keep my yard, if I don't want the invasives to be marching right up to the house, right? And there's actually quite a bit of research from what I understand, and I don't have I don't have hands on it, but I was told it by a land manager that Japanese barberry is one of the invasives we have here in southeastern PA. It's a very thorny plant that spreads like crazy, and apparently it is associated with increased mice populations because foxes don't like to chase the mice underneath these barberry plants. And then increased mice populations in equals increased tick populations, and you have your back around to bad, bad juju. So I was very unhappy that I was starting to resort to these things, but it all happened in 1 year. And I guess I'll give a plug for one more: air conditioning. I love air conditioning. Air conditioning is great. We suffered it, for many years here without air conditioning, but it was actually those wildfires that. We couldn't cool the house down by keeping the windows open. We couldn't keep the windows open because we had a baby in the house. And it was like, the hell are we going to do now? So I fished an old air conditioner out of the basement that later exploded in my kitchen and flooded, one corner of the kitchen because it had been sitting around for 10 years. But yeah, that's my struggle. And I talk a little bit about some of the invasive elements and how I felt like I was not able to manage the things that were creeping up on me. And a plug for The Green Knight, the movie, where somebody gives a speech about the green encroaching on your life and swallowing everything about your life. I definitely identify with that idea. So yeah, that's where that's coming from. Yeah, I'm clearly still getting over it, which is why I wrote the piece, and I was glad that Front Porch Republic picked it up. That was They told me it was very honest. I said, "Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is. It's not my favorite thing to
Now I
talk about."
understand why you see nature as the enemy. Now it's all coming together.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and I mean,
I haven't. I'm only on my fourth year. I don't
okay.
feel besieged by invasives yet. Things seem.
Don't you have young kids?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah, that slowed me down, and that's what.
Well,
That
we
slowed me
started
down.
when my older was two, and so. This whole time has been operating on very little budget, so we don't make that much money, and so and not that much time, and just kind of what can we do
Yeah.
with that? So, but yeah, I'm not 10 years into it. Who knows what surprises?
Yeah, and I don't know, I feel old. I'm like, I can't swing that scythe the way I used to. I'm doing the best. And Gigi, I know you're trying to start a homestead journey, so try not to get too dissuaded.
Well, I'm gonna be
Gigi, tell us
down. I'm gonna be
about
down
that.
near. I'm gonna be down near Jason. I'm gonna be down in the south,
Yeah,
doing that. So in
we
southern
all have
Appalachia. So
kudzu, which is next
we're gonna get
level.
some goats. We'll just get some goats, and they
Yeah.
can eat away at the kudzu. Actually, where my land doesn't have any kudzu on it, so I shouldn't have to worry about
Yeah.
that.
So
That's good.
tell us more, Gigi, about why you're interested in homesteading, why Southern Appalachia is the best part of the country because it is. And what you're thinking.
There, Jason, that's why.
What's that?
Yeah, it's because I'm from there.
Is
That's why
what?
it's the greatest. Because I'm from there. That's why
Oh, of
it's the
course.
greatest. Yeah.
Sorry.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello. I grew up. No, Southern Appalachia. Well, I just think the South in general is just such a hospitable culture. It just is. And so I enjoy the hospitality. I grew up in a really rural part of Georgia. I grew up canning, breaking beans. I mean, we went and picked green beans
Breaking
at, 6 o'clock in the morning. I always say that my forearms are big because I carried 5 gallon buckets of green beans my whole life,
beans.
and us would string and break beans. And I just grew up in an agrarian type setting. My family, they were all farmers, and I have family land that's sitting there, and just this whole conversation has confirmed that having land is something that's really valuable, and I have land. And so just and that the land has been in my family for five generations, and just to not cultivate it, to not make the most of it, for my children, for my children's children, just seems like a total waste. So I'd like to just get in there and see what I can do. I have lots of ambition. We'll see if I can actually bring any of that ambition to fruition, but My little town has turned into a tourist attraction. So a lot of people come there to stay in cabins, to do a lot of outdoorsy things, camp, go down the river, that kind of thing. And a lot of people kind of, I think Will, you said this, have sold off family land to develop it into, neighborhoods, to subdivisions. And I am just kind of hell-bent on never letting that happen to the land that I have remaining. So just kind of going there and fighting against the temptation that people feel to make a buck on grandma's land, and kind of maybe going in and offering a different perspective on how we can preserve the town without completely chopping up the land, selling it off, and we'll see. We'll see what happens. But I have a school situation there also, so we'll see. We'll see what happens.
That's very exciting. Maybe when you're like a year into it, we should do a podcast
Y'all should come visit me.
what's that?
Come down to just come visit me. Just come down to
Yeah,
Georgia.
I'd love to.
I'll host y'all. We'll have
You're in northern Georgia?
Northern Georgia. Yeah, we'll just have a weenie roast, do bonfire, do a whole thing. It'd be so great.
We
All the
need to have
doom
a
rockmism
whole Southern
people.
Appalachia or Central Southern Appalachia kind of gathering. There's a number of us.
Yes, I would love that. I'll just host you all. It'll be great. We'll have a bonfire. It'll be super. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so we probably need to wrap up in about 10 minutes. Are there any other topics of conversation that we want to make sure that we cover before we wrap up?
I guess what's the optimist take from you guys? Like what makes you optimistic? I mean, other than the kiddos, because that's the only thing. I mean,
This guy, one
that's
half of a big part of what makes me optimistic.
yeah, that changes everything.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I've studied most ways to be a doomer. Like I study it pretty intensely. I teach in a sustainable development program, and it's very, critical of the current trajectories. And so I study those things. I teach about those things. So I understand, I think pretty well. But one, I think just personally, when you're stewarding a piece of land, I find it's very hard to be pessimistic about life, even if it's just your own life and your family's life, because I'm in just some beauty every day, and I'm able to cultivate beauty and see the product, of my labor as well. And and in this region, there's a lot of other people doing the same thing. There's still an agrarian culture here. A lot of it is becoming touristy or commercialized, and that's the big issue. But there is a real kind of agrarian memory here. It's still part of the culture, and it's still valued. And so that's optimistic.
Gotcha.
I have a big thought that I'm tr having trouble putting into words. I think from there, I think that people are resilient. Humans are very resilient. I think a lot of our life support systems will be breaking down, but I think that hopefully, if it doesn't happen all at once, that'll be impetus to reorganize, to reorganize our lives more meaningfully, in a more regenerative sense. That's my optimism, and that's what DO, I think that's what we're trying to do, is connect with people in this world who are thinking along similar lines, create this network, connect with other networks that are doing similar things. And that makes me optimistic, is just we feel like we're planting seeds everywhere, or we're connecting with seeds everywhere, and these can grow. So just like, and that's a agricultural analogy, right? I can see cultural potential growing, just like I see plants growing, trees growing. So that's what makes me optimistic. What about you, Gigi? What makes you optimistic?
Same things. Like I don't know. I just feel hopeful. Like I kind of feel that everything kind of all works out in the end. Maybe that's a little too romantic. Maybe that's a little maybe too optimistic. But I guess I accept that things that I want to see change or things that I would like to see evolve might not happen in my lifetime. And I accept that. I think there's a part of the optimism that is acceptance, that you just kind of do, you plod along, you do a little by little, and you pass a little something down to your children, and you just kind of hope and pray that they take that on. You impress values upon them, principles. You try to teach them, and you hope that they carry on your legacy. But ultimately, I just do think everything works out in the end, and I think the Shire is worth saving. And I don't know, maybe that sounds really cheesy, but that's just my thought.
Now, in a similar vein, I've read tons of doomers. I mean, I've been reading the worst predictions of all, and one of the problems I've found is that they rarely turn out the way that the Nostradamus put them out there as. It does not usually take the shape, and I've particularly looked at financial ruin. I've been reading people talk about the debt this and the financial system and things like that. It does not turn out that way. Usually reality is a sort of a muddle, and history turns into a long, long, long muddle rather than a lot of sharp events that happen. And what you get when that muddle happens, it seems to me, is a lot of space to make some cool things happen. And so I wouldn't write unless I thought there was unless I thought there was an audience that could have their lives changed by it. I'm really hoping the new book is transformative for that community, and even in a small sense. But one very small anecdote. As I said, I live on the edge of these state lands, and we've been cultivating this permaculture food forest of natives, right? I mean, we're trying to plant natives. The peaches obviously aren't natives, but I love peaches. But we I started to notice on the game lands in this immediate area that I walk through a lot, some elderberries popping up that weren't there before. And I was like, you know what? I think it's going in the opposite direction. They keep sending me the stupid invasive species off of that land, but I think it's also moving in the other direction. And one of the things about those seeds is you don't know where they go. You have no idea. And I've had people come back to me many years after doing some social work, things like that, who come back and they say, you have no idea that the little thing you said that one time that changed, they changed all my perceptions. It was a major moment. And I know that's been the case for me for sure. And so yeah, that in that sense, if history is that muddle, you have way more chances to jump in rather than an asteroid hitting the Earth. I mean, whatever, like, forget it. But it's rarely an asteroid. It's usually a very much a it's a simpler thing. It moves on in a simpler way, which is gives you some room. So yeah, that's I appreciate you guys having me on here. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Will.
I
Yeah,
don't
this
get
is
to
great.
talk about this stuff with many people. You bring this up at a family reunion, you know what happens?
What are they like? They're like checking out after like 2 minutes.
They're like, all right, I'm gonna go back to the table and get some more food. I'm like,
Right.
I'm done
Yeah.
talking about this.
Well,
Or somebody
that's why
gets
I wanted
too
to connect.
into it and gets scared.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to connect you here, because I just know it very much is like Jason said, you're a fellow traveler of this group. I mean, everything you've been doing is very much aligned with what Jason and Ashley and all of them are trying to do. So glad that these worlds could collide and
Most
we
definitely.
could collaborate on this.
Yeah, thank you, Gigi. This is great. It's really a pleasure to meet you, Will. And our kind of MO on the podcast, when we meet fellow travelers, I know you've done a lot of podcasting and you don't have much time, but feel free to utilize this platform if there's somebody you want to interview or something. We have dozens of hosts, or I think we counted, we have 30 people who have posted, 15 more than once. And so we try and kind of, that's our growth strategy, is to empower people to take ownership of the kind of project. And so
Yeah,
just
pay it
want
forward.
to put that out there as well.
Cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate you guys. Thank you.
All right. Well, until next time, see you then.
All right.
Yep,
See you
thanks,
guys.
Jason. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.